For convenience of reference, the subdivisions of the first and second elemental kingdoms are tabulated thus: colon, plane, subplanes, elemental subdivisions, kingdoms, higher mental 1 first 2 2 3 4 3 5 6 7 4 1 second lower 5 2 3 mental 6 4 5 7 6 7. After spending a whole chain period at this stage, the continuous downward pressure has caused the process to repeat itself. Once more, the life has identified itself with its forms, and has taken up its residence on the lower mental levels. Then it takes for itself forms of astral matter, and becomes the third elemental kingdom. Page 14. As we saw in the astral body and the mental body, both mental and astral elemental essences are very intimately connected with man, entering largely into the composition of his vehicles. After spending a whole chain period in the third elemental kingdom, the life again identifies itself with those forms, and so is able to ensoul the etheric part of the mineral kingdom, becoming the life which vivifies that kingdom. In the course of the mineral evolution, the downward pressure again causes the life to identify itself with the etheric forms, and from those forms to ensoul the denser matter of such minerals as are perceptible to our senses. What we know as a mineral kingdom includes, of course, not only what are usually called minerals, but also liquids, gases, and many etheric substances, as yet unknown to Western Orthodox science. When in the mineral kingdom, the life is sometimes called the mineral monad, just as at later stages it has been named the vegetable monad, and the animal monad. These titles, however, are somewhat misleading, because they seem to suggest that one great monad animates the entire kingdom, which is not the case, because even when the monadic essence first appears before us as the first elemental kingdom, it is already not one monad, but very many monads, not one great life stream, but many parallel streams, each possessing characteristics of its own. When the outpouring has reached the central point of the mineral kingdom, the downward pressure ceases, and is replaced by an upward tendency. The outbreathing has ceased, and the inbreathing or indrawing has begun. It will be noted that, if there were but one outpouring of life, which passed from one kingdom to the next, there would be in existence at any given time one kingdom only. This, however, as we know, is not the case. The reason is that the Logos sends out a constant succession of waves of life, so that at any given time we find a number of them in operation. Thus we ourselves represent one such wave. The wave that immediately followed our wave now ensouls the animal kingdom. The wave behind that is now in the vegetable kingdom, a fourth is in the mineral stage, whilst a fifth, sixth and seventh are represented by the three elemental kingdoms. All are successive ripples of the same great outpouring from the second aspect of the Logos. The whole scheme tends increasingly towards differentiation, the streams as they descend from kingdom to kingdom dividing and subdividing more and more. It may be that before all this evolution takes place there is a point at which we may think of the great outpouring as homogeneous, but of that, nothing is known. The process of subdivision continues until, at the end of the first great stage of evolution, it is finally divided into individualities, that is, into men, each man being a separate and distinct soul, though at first, of course, an undeveloped soul. Page 15. Looking at the work of the second life waves, or second outpouring, as a whole, we may fairly regard its downward sweep as concerned with the making of primary tissues, out of which in due time, subtle and dense bodies will be formed. In certain ancient scriptures this process has been aptly called weaving. The materials which are prepared by the third Logos, are woven by the second Logos into threads and fabrics out of which future garments, that is, bodies will be made. The third Logos may be thought of as a chemist, working as in a laboratory; the second Logos we may regard as the weaver, working as in manufactory. Materialistic as are these similes, they are useful as crutches for the understanding. The second Logos thus weaves various kinds of cloth, that is, of material, out of which will later be made the causal and mental bodies of men; out of the cloth of astral matter, of desire stuff, will later be made the astral bodies of men. Thus are fashioned the materials of the mechanism of consciousness, The characteristics of each class of material being determined by the nature of the aggregations of particles, texture, color, density, and so forth. All this downward sweep of the life wave through the planes, giving qualities to the many grades of matter, is a preparation for evolution and is often and more properly called involution. After the lowest stage of immersion in matter is reached, both the first and the second outpouring turn upwards and begin their long ascent through the planes. This is evolution properly so called. Diagram V is an attempt to illustrate graphically the first outpouring from the third logos, forming the matter of the five lower planes, and the second outpouring which, taking the matter vivified by the third logos, molds and ensouls it so as to produce the three elemental kingdoms, and the mineral kingdom, and in due succession, the vegetable, and animal kingdoms. There is indicated also on the diagram the third outpouring, from the first logos, the outpouring from which results the formation of individual entities, or human beings. With this, however, we shall deal more fully at a later stage of our study. The student should take careful note of the exact position of the figures in diagram V, representing each kingdom. Thus the mineral is shown of full width in the denser part of the physical plane, showing that the life there, such as it is, has full control over the dense physical matter. But the band grows steadily narrower as it mounts up through the etheric subplanes, indicating that control over etheric matter is not yet perfectly developed. Page 16. The small point penetrating into the astral plane indicates that a little consciousness works through astral matter. This consciousness is the beginning of desire, expressed in the mineral kingdom as chemical affinity, etc. We shall refer to this again when we come to the mineral group souls. The band representing the vegetable kingdom has full width in the whole of the physical plane, dense as well as etheric. The portion representing astral consciousness is, of course, much larger, because desire is much more fully developed in the vegetable than in the mineral kingdom. Students of plant life will know that many members of the vegetable kingdom exhibit a great deal of ingenuity and sagacity in attaining their ends, limited though those ends seem to us, regarded from our point of view. The student is recommended in this connection to such books as The Sagacity and Morality of Plants, by J. E. Taylor. In the animal kingdom, the band shows that there is full development in the lowest astral subplane, showing that the animal is capable of experiencing to the fullest possible extent the lower desires, but the narrowing of the band through the higher subplanes shows that his capacity for the higher desires is much more limited. Nevertheless, it does exist, so that it happens, in exceptional cases, that he may manifest an exceedingly high quality of affection and devotion. The band representing the animal shows also that there is already a development of intelligence, which needs mental matter for its expression. It is now generally admitted that some animals, both domestic and wild, undoubtedly exercise the power of reasoning from cause to effect, although the lines along which their reason can work are naturally few and limited, not is the faculty powerful yet. As the band is intended to represent the average animal, the point pierces only into the lowest subplane of the mental plane. With the highly developed domestic animal, the point might readily extend even to the highest of the four lower levels, though of course it would remain only a point, and by no means the full width of the band. As we are considering here the relative degrees of consciousness in the various kingdoms, we may as well anticipate somewhat, and indicate the stage at which man has arrived. The band representing the human kingdom is seen to be of full width up to the lowest level of the mental plane, indicating that up to that level his reasoning faculty is fully developed. In the higher subdivisions of the lower mental plane, page 17, the faculty of reason is not yet fully developed, as indicated by the narrowing of the band. An entirely new factor, however, is introduced by the point on the higher mental or causal plane, because man possesses a causal body and a permanent reincarnating ego. In the case of the great majority of men, the consciousness does not rise beyond the third mental subplane. Gradually only, as his development proceeds, the ego is able to raise his consciousness to the second or the first of the mental subplanes. The band on the extreme right-hand side represents a man much in advance of the ordinary man. Here we have the consciousness of a highly spiritual man, whose consciousness has evolved beyond that of the causal body, so that he can function freely on the plane of body, and also has consciousness, at least when out of the body, on the plane of Atma. It will be noted that the center of his consciousness indicated by the widest part of the band, is not, as in the case of most men, on the physical and astral planes but between the higher mental and the buddhic planes. The higher mental and higher astral are much more developed than are their lower parts, and although he still retains his physical body, yet this is indicated merely by a point, the explanation being that he holds it solely for the convenience of working in it, and not in any way because his thoughts and desires are fixed there. Such a man has transcended all karma which could bind him to incarnation, so that he takes the lower vehicles solely in order that through them he may be able to work for the good of humanity and to pour out at those levels those forces which otherwise could not descend so far. After this necessary discretion, in order to explain the relative degrees of consciousness attained by each of the kingdoms of nature, it is important to note that the evolutionary process, which leads into expression the involved consciousness, has to begin by contacts received by its outermost vehicle, that is, it must begin on the physical plane. The consciousness can become aware of an outside only by impacts on its own outside. Until then, it dreams within itself, as the faint inner thrillings ever outwelling from the monad cause slight pressure in the Javatma, Atma Buddhist manas, like a spring of water beneath the earth, seeking an outlet. With this process of ascent, and the third outpouring, which results in the formation of the causal body of the man, we shall deal in succeeding chapters, in due course. Reverting to the second outpouring, we must note that it not only divides itself to an almost infinite degree, but also appears to differentiate itself, so that it comes through countless millions of channels on every plane and subplane. Thus, on the buddhic plane it appears as the Christ principle in man. In man's mental and astral bodies it vivifies various layers of matter, appearing in the higher part of the astral as a noble emotion, in the lower part as a mere rush of life force energizing the matter of the body. In its lowest embodiment, it rushes from the astral body into the etheric chakrams or force centers, where it meets the kundalini welling up from the interior of the human body. Page 18. We may also note here, parenthetically, that kundalini, or the serpent fire, which wells up from the interior of the human body, belongs to the first outpouring, and exists on all planes of which we know anything. This force of kundalini is, of course, quite distinct from prana or vitality, which belongs to the second outpouring, and also from fohat, that is, from all forms of physical energy such as electricity, light, heat, etc. vidi the etheric double, the astral body and the mental body. Passive kundalini in the human body comes from that laboratory of the Holy Ghost deep down in the earth, where are still being manufactured new chemical elements, showing increasing complexity of form, and more energetic, internal life and activity. But kundalini is not that portion of the first outpouring engaged in the work of building chemical elements. It is more of the nature of the further development of the force which is in the living center of such elements as radium. Kundalini is part of the first outpouring after it has reached its lowest immersion in matter, and is once more ascending towards the heights from which it came. It has already been mentioned that, speaking generally, the life wave which descends through the worlds of matter, on its downward sweep, causes ever-increasing differentiation. On its upward return, however, it brings about reintegration into unity. Page 19, Chapter 6. The attachment of the atoms. I. Higher tried the second outpouring not only, as we saw in the preceding chapter, streams forth into the five planes, thereby bringing into existence the elemental and other kingdoms of life, but it brings also with it into activity the monads, who while ready to begin their evolution, have been waiting on the Anupadaka plane until the matter of the planes was prepared for them. To say that the monads go forth would be somewhat inaccurate. It is rather that they shine forth, sending out their rays of life. They themselves remain ever in the bosom of the Father, while their life rays stream out into the ocean of matter, appropriating there, as we shall see in full detail presently, the materials necessary for their evolution in the lower planes. The shining fourth of the monads has been graphically described by H.P. Blavatsky. Thus, the primordial triangle, that is, the three-faced monad of will, wisdom, and activity, as soon as it has reflected itself in the heavenly man that is .atma, buddhi, manas, the highest of the lower seven, disappears, returning into silence and darkness. The monads themselves, therefore, remain ever beyond the fivefold universe, and in that sense are spectators. They dwell beyond the five planes of matter. They are the self, standing self-conscious, and self-determined. They reign in changeless peace and live in eternity. But, as we have seen, they appropriate matter, taking to themselves atoms of various planes. The monads are of seven types or rays, just as matter also is of seven types or rays. The process by which the seven types arise is as follows. The three aspects of consciousness of the Logos or Universal Self are will, Ichha, wisdom, Jnanam, and activity, Kriya. The three corresponding qualities in matter are inertia, Dharmas, mobility, Rajas, and rhythm, Sattva. These are related as follows. The aspect of will imposes on matter the quality of inertia or Dharmas, the power of resistance, stability, quietude. The aspect of activity gives to matter its responsiveness to action, mobility, or rajas. The aspect of wisdom gives to matter rhythm or sattva, harmony. Diagram 7 shows these correspondences. Page 20. Now every monad has these three aspects of consciousness, the proportions of which may vary in different monads in seven ways. Thus, predominant aspect, secondary aspect, tertiary aspect, will, wisdom, activity, will. The seventh variety is that in which the three aspects are equal. The seven types of matter are similarly formed, by the varying proportions of the three qualities dharmas, rajas, and sattva. The stream of life known as the second outpouring, in fact, is composed of seven streams, one of the seven types of matter combinations being found in each of the seven streams. Diagram 8 is an attempt to show the seven types of monads with the seven corresponding types of matter. Another way of expressing the same truth, viz., that each monad belongs to one or other of the seven rays, is to say that he came forth originally through one or other of the seven planetary logoi, who may be regarded as centers of force within the solar logos, channels through which the force of the solar logos is poured out. Nevertheless, although as has been said, each monad belongs fundamentally to one ray, yet he has within himself something of all the rays. There is in him no ounce of force, no grain of matter, which is not actually part of one or other of the seven planetary logoi. He is literally compacted of their very substance, not of one, but of all, though always one predominates. Therefore, no slightest movement of any of these great star angels can occur without affecting to some extent every monad, because they are bone of their bone, flesh of their flesh, spirit of their spirit. This fact is, of course, the real basis of astrology. Furthermore, the bodies of those monads, which originally came forth through a given planetary logos, will continue all through their evolution to have more of the particles of that logos than of any other, and, page 21. In this way man can be distinguished as primarily belonging to one or other of the seven rays or logoi. Whilst the ordinary rule is that a monad remains on the same ray throughout the whole of his evolution, so that he eventually returns through the same planetary angel as that through which he first came forth, yet there are comparatively rare exceptions. For it is possible for a monad to change his ray so that he will return through a planetary angel other than that through which he first emerged. Such transfers are usually to the first and second rays, there being relatively few persons on those two rays at the lower levels of evolution. Before we can proceed to describe the method by which the atoms are attached to the monads, there is still another factor with which we must first deal. The second outpouring, in addition to its work of forming the elemental and other kingdoms, also brings with it evolved beings, at various stages of development, who form the normal and typical inhabitants of the three elemental kingdoms. These beings have been brought over by the Logos from a preceding evolution. They are now sent forth to inhabit the plane for which their development fits them, They cooperate with the work of the Logos, and later with man, in the general scheme of evolution. From them, man derives his perishable bodies. They are known in some religions as angels, to Hindus as devas, meaning literally, shining ones. Plato speaks of them as minor gods. It is the translation of the word deva as gods which has led to much misapprehension of Eastern thought. The 33 crores, 330 millions, of gods, are not gods in the Western sense of the term, but are devas or shining ones. Of these there are many grades, including representatives on each of the five lower planes, that is, those of Atma, Buddhi, Manas, Karna, and the etheric part of the physical plane. Their bodies are formed of the elemental essence of the kingdom to which they belong, and are flashing and many-hued, changing form at the will of the entity himself. They form a vast host, ever actively at work, laboring at the elemental essence to improve its quality, taking it to form their own bodies, throwing it off again and taking other portions, so as to render it more sensitive. In the first elemental kingdom, on the higher mental or causal plane, they make materials ready to clothe abstract thoughts. In the second elemental kingdom, on the lower mental plane, they make materials ready to clothe concrete thoughts. In the third elemental kingdom, on the astral plane, they prepare materials for the clothing of desires. At the stage which we are now considering, this work of improving the elemental essence is the only work there is for them to do. Later on, they are also constantly busied in the shaping of forms, in aiding human egos on the way to incarnation in building their new bodies, bringing materials of the kind required and helping in its arrangements. The less advanced the ego, the greater the directive work of the devas. With animals they do almost all the work, and practically all with the vegetables and minerals. They are, page 22, the active agents of the Logos, carrying out all details of his world plan, and aiding the countless evolving lives to find materials they need for their clothing and use. Included with them are the vast numbers of the fairy kingdom, known as nature spirits, trolls, gnomes, and by countless other names. Some description of these hosts of beings is given in the astral body and the mental body, so that there is no need to describe them further here. All we are really concerned with at the moment is their origin, and the part they play in helping the monads to commence their evolution in the lower planes. The term deva is, strictly speaking, not wide enough to cover all the living agencies which are employed in the work connected with the monads and their long pilgrimage through the lower worlds. This work is carried out by no less than seven orders of beings, known collectively as creative hierarchies, the monads, themselves, curiously enough, being one of the seven. For our present purposes, however, in order not to make the description too complicated and involved, we shall denote all these agencies by the single term devas. In a later and separate chapter we shall to some extent go over the ground again more in detail, and give the names and functions, so far as these are known, of the seven creative hierarchies. Thus we see that before any embodied consciousness, save that of the Logos and his creative hierarchies, could appear, or do anything at all, a vast preliminary work had to be accomplished, preparing the form side of the field of evolution. We have now the three factors needed to enable us to consider the attachment of the atoms to the monads. These three are, 1, the atoms of the various planes, 2, the readiness of the monads themselves on the Anupadaka plane, 3, the assistance of the devas, without whom the monads by themselves would be powerless to carry out their evolution. A monad, as we have seen, possesses three aspects of consciousness, each of which, when the time comes for evolutionary process to begin, sets up what may be termed a vibratory wave, thus causing to vibrate the atomic matter of the planes of Atma, Buddhi, and Manas, which surrounds him. Devas from a previous universe, who have themselves passed through a similar experience before, guide the vibratory wave from the will aspect of the monad to an atom of Atma, which thus becomes attached to the monad, and is its atmic permanent atom, so called because it remains with the monad throughout the whole process of evolution. Similarly, the vibratory wave from the wisdom aspect of the monad is guided by devas to an atom of, page 23, Buddhi, which becomes the buddhic permanent atom. Similarly, also, the vibratory wave from the activity aspect of the monad is guided by devas and attached to an atom of manas, which becomes the third permanent atom. Thus is formed atma-buddhi manas, often called the ray of the monad. Diagram 9 illustrates the process just described. A graphic description of the process is as follows. From the luminous ocean of Atma, a tiny thread of light is separated off from the rest by a film of Buddhic matter, and from this hangs a spark which becomes enclosed in an egg-like casing of matter belonging to the formless levels of the mental plane. The spark hangs from the flame by the finest thread of Fohat. The Book of Dzogchen, 7.5. As said, those atoms which are attached to monads become, and are called, permanent atoms. H.P. Blavatsky spoke of them as life atoms, the Secret Doctrine, 2.709. The remainder of the atoms of the various planes, which are not attached to monads, remain and continue to be called the monadic essence of each plane. The term is perhaps a little misleading, but it was given in the first instance, because, as mentioned in Chapter 5, the essence at this stage is suitable to be attached to monads as permanent atoms, though by no means all of it does actually become attached. Atma-buddhi manas, the ray of the monad, is known also by many other names, such as the heavenly man, the spiritual or higher triad, the higher self, the separated self, and so on. The term jivatma is also sometimes applied to it, though jivatma, which may be rendered literally life self, is of course equally applicable to the monad. It is known also as the manhood of the divine son of the first logos, animated by the Godhead, that is, by the monad. It may be regarded also as a vessel into which the monad pours his life. Page 24. Here we have the mystery of the watcher, the spectator, the actionless atma, that is, the monad, who abides ever in his highest nature on his own plane, and lives in the world by his ray, atma-buddhi manas, which in turn animates his shadows, the lives or incarnations of the lower self on earth. Diagram X illustrates the monad and his higher triad. It is important to remember that atma-buddhi manas, the higher triad, is identical in nature with the monad, in fact is the monad, though lessened in force by the veils of matter round it. This lessening of power must not blind us to the identity of nature, for it must ever be borne in mind that human consciousness is a unit, though its manifestations vary owing to the predominance of one or other of its aspects and to the relative density of the materials in which an aspect is working at any given moment. The monad, having thus appropriated for his own use these three atoms, has begun his work. He himself in his own nature cannot descend below the Anupadaka plane, hence he is said to be in silence and darkness, that is, unmanifest. But he lives and works in and by means of the atoms he has appropriated. Although the monad on his own plane, the Anupadaka, so far as his internal life is concerned, is strong, conscious, capable, yet on the lower planes in their time and space limitations, he is a mere germ, an embryo, powerless, senseless, helpless. Although at first the matter of the lower planes enslaves him, he will slowly, surely, mold it for self-expression. In this he is watched over and aided by the all-sustaining and preserving life of the second logos, until eventually he can live in the lower worlds as fully as he lives above, and become in his turn a creative logos, and bring forth out of himself a universe. For a logos does not create out of nothing, he evolves all from himself. The full manifestation of the three aspects of consciousness expressed by the monad takes place in the same order as the manifestation of the triple logos in the universe. The third aspect, activity, revealed as the creative mind, as the gatherer of knowledge, is the first to perfect its vehicles. The second aspect, wisdom, revealed as the pure and compassionate reason, or intuition, is the second to shine forth. This is the Krishna, the Christ in man. The third aspect, will, the divine power of the self, the Atma is the last to reveal itself. Page 25, Chapter 7, the attachment of the atoms to lower triad, the spiritual triad, Atma-buddhi manas. Having been formed, the warmth of the stream of logoic life arouses within it faint thrillings of responsive life. After long preparation, a tiny thread, like a minute rootlet, a golden-colored thread of life sheathed in Buddhic matter, proceeds from the triad. This thread is sometimes called the Sutratma, literally the thread self, because the permanent particles will be threaded on it like beads on a string. The term, however, is used in various ways, but always to denote the idea of a thread connecting separate particles.